As we do, let us remember the audience are those Jews that had obeyed the gospel. More likely than not, the Jews that lived in and around Jerusalem are the main recipients of this letter. As we have said on numerous occasions, they were suffering a persecution that the likes of that it's difficult for us to completely identify with, because they were totally ostracized by their families, even to the point of no longer being considered a family member, no longer having their inheritance taken away, being an outcast in their community. We'll not take the time to review all of the chapters thus far, but we are in chapter 12 as we continue our study. By going into that chapter, we need to remind ourselves the doctrinal portion of this book is now over. That ended in chapter 10. Even in the doctrinal portion, there was a constant theme of the writer of the epistle setting forth the advantages of Christ versus Moses, the advantages of the new covenant versus the old, and so forth, those kinds of themes. And based on that, he's encouraging them to not fall away. He made a rather lengthy pitch on that in chapter 10 about not falling away. For example, 10 and verse 35, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward, because we have need of endurance. And certainly that's applicable to us today as well, so that after we have done the will of God, we may receive the promise. He makes the point that the just shall live by faith. And he adds a word of encouragement in verse 20 or 39 of that chapter. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. I think it's interesting that he places himself in that same group with those brethren. We are not of those who draw back to perdition. So he's trying to instill in them some confidence. In chapter 12, probably the chapter that most of us know the best, Hall of Fame of the Faithful, he goes through a number of Old Testament worthies describing the great things they did in the kingdom of God. And how did they do those things? They did so by faith. And in each case, there was some action they took. It was not merely some sort of a mental process, but it was faith coupled with works, as James chapter 2 says. I think it's particularly interesting as he gets to the latter part of that chapter, he no longer is going through these people by name, but he's just mentioning some of the things that they accomplished. For example, they slew mouths of lions in verse 33, obviously a reference to the exploits of Daniel. They quenched the violence of fire, obviously referring to Daniel's companions, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They did all kinds of noteworthy things through their faith. And because of that, how does he describe them? I love the description in verse 38, of whom the world was not worthy. What a aspiration for each of us as Christians to live a life that could be said of us, that the world was not worthy of us. Not trying to poke the world in the eye, so to speak, but just the fact that of living a life worthy of Christ and not worthy of the world. So, as he draws that chapter to a close and begins the next chapter, what does the next chapter begin with? Therefore. So, based on all of these faithful people that he's just mentioned, he's going to make another run at this idea of remaining faithful. He says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. The cloud of witnesses are all of these Old Testament worthies mentioned in chapter 11. the force of the language there is that it's as if the current day Christians, in this case, these Hebrew Christians, today it's us in the same position. It's as if we are in an Olympic stadium and we are the participants. We are the athletes, if you will, down on the playing field, competing in the games. And these faithful ones that have passed on, they're in the audience, watching and cheering us on, hoping and encouraging us to live the same life of faithfulness that they lived. So what a great encouragement to think that, I don't know if this is just a metaphor or whether in actuality, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all of those ancient faithfuls on the other side of Jordan now are able to see us or not. I don't know, but certainly we can conjure up that image as a way to encourage ourselves. That being the case, what we need to do something. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. So the first thing we need to do, it's again using the athletic metaphor, in training, what would an athlete do? An athlete, for example, might put weights, this was common back in that day and time, and it's common today, put weights on their legs, for example, to strengthen their legs so that they could run better when the competition actually came. But when the competition comes, what do you do with the weights? You don't leave them on, you take them off. And that's what he's encouraging us to do. Take off those weights and avoid this sin that so easily ensnares us. Now, some want to make this sin something peculiar to each one of us. You know, each one of us have some sort of a thing that maybe tempts us more than it tempts others. I think he's just talking about sin in general and the fact that it's easily to get caught up in sin, isn't it, if we're not paying attention. So we have to pay close attention. We have to run this race with endurance. I used to be a jogger. I was never one that ran in races, but I identified this with this, that when I would go on my five-mile jog, I would constantly have to encourage myself along the way to keep going because, you know, it's pretty easy sometimes to say, well, you know, I'm a little bit tired today, so I think I'll just stop and turn back. No, you just got to keep encouraging yourself. And I would get to the point sometimes I'd just say, okay, well, just one more step, one more step, one more step. And finally, with that strategy, I would be able to finish the race that was set before me. So we run. The Christian life is an endurance race. It's not a sprint. So we have to do that. We have to put aside every weight and the sin that easily ensnares us, but we need to do something else. Looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. What's at the finish line? Victory's at the finish line. Who's waiting at the finish line in the Christian race? It's Jesus himself. I like to meditate, especially at night as when I go to bed. And one thing I think about is I'm so thankful for what Jesus has done for me that one of the first things I would like to be able to do when I get to heaven is just wrap my arms around him and hug him and thank him for all that he's done for me. So we need to, as we're running that race, keep our eyes on the author and the finisher of our faith. Now, he has some special qualities that we also need to think about. Who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame. He was able to look beyond that which he was suffering. There was two things about the cross. I think enduring the cross, in my mind, is the idea of enduring the pain that the cross brought. And we've talked about that many times. We talk about it often before we partake of the Lord's Supper. I'm thankful for Jonathan bringing up the that word, now I'm having a senior moment, excruciating, yeah. Because that word was basically invented to describe the pain of the cross. When we partake of the Lord's Supper, I try to think of that. First of all, think about the beating that he took and how painful that must have been. I'm convinced that was why, one of the reasons why he died before the others was because he was already close to death because of the beating that he endured. That beating was so terrific that he couldn't carry the cross to the place of crucifixion. He was so weakened by that. And then I imagine him as they bring him to the place of crucifixion. I know if I were a Roman soldier in charge of crucifixions, my assumption would be when you get to the place of crucifixion that every victim is going to resist. He didn't resist. But in my mind, I can imagine them throwing him down on the ground and very roughly getting a hold of him. And they must have restrained them in some way, in my mind. For example, wrapped ropes around their arms to the cross before they put the nails in. Otherwise, it would be hard to hold on to their arms and their feet. And I think of those nails being driven into his flesh, especially the feet. I just can't imagine how painful that must have been. Then they've got to raise the cross up. In my mind, there's a hole there, and they must have been soldiers with ropes guiding that cross into the hole that was going to hold it and then pulling the ropes up. And I don't imagine they did it very gently. And then the cross falling down into that hole, the jarring that must have been, and the pain that ripped through his hands and his feet. And then suspended on the cross, struggling to gain the next breath. If you've ever had the wind knocked out of you, you know how terrifying it is when you can't get your breath. It's not just painful, it's scary. And you would go through that for hours. So he endured that because he was able to look beyond that to what that would bring, the glory that it would bring. Then he despised the shame. I don't think that we in this day and age fully appreciate that. Over the centuries, the cross has become in many ways a positive thing because what was accomplished there. But that was the worst form of punishment in that day and age. Only the most vile criminal was nailed to a cross. It would be akin today it would be even worse than going to the electric chair or being hung. It was that despicable. So he was able to look beyond that, and because of that, what happened? He sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. God exalted him for his humility, Philippians 2. He not only humbled himself by taking on the form of a servant and coming as a man, he went through the ultimate humiliation of the cross. And because of his humiliation, God exalted him. For consider him, verse 3, who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. When I read that verse, I think of all of the people from the beginning of his trial right on through his death on the cross that hurled epithets at him. That criticized him. For example, the soldiers that smote him on the head. Prophesy, who smote you? The scribes and the Pharisees at the base of the cross, come down from the cross and we'll believe you, and so forth. The crowd that earlier had cried out hosannas to him as he made his triumphant entry, and now they're saying, crucify him, crucify him. So think of that hostility that was directed at him. That would definitely be hard to take. So we need to think about that. Well, none of us will ever go through that degree of hostility from sinners that he went through. Verse 4, you have not yet resisted the bloodshed, striving against sin. Certainly over the years, many Christians have been martyred, have resisted the bloodshed. Folks had not, and none of us here have had to do that. And hopefully none of us will ever have to do that. But Jesus did that. He was willing to resist even to bloodshed, striving against sin. And another reason why we need to run the race with endurance, you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. Now he quotes from the Proverbs. He says, my son, do not despise the chastening or the discipline of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. So as we go through the trials and the tribulations of life, we need to realize that these things are for our good. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials, James said. Turn over to Romans chapter 5. Paul talks about this. In Romans 5, he says that we should glory, verse 3, in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. Now, hope does not disappoint. We'll not be disappointed going through trials and tribulations if we do it the right way, trusting in God, because it will strengthen our hope. I think it's very important to know that to not misinterpret this. I don't believe that God personally starts throwing all of these things in our path, because we know in the book of James that God does not tempt any man, but God allows us to be tested. To me, that's one of the main points of the book of Job. Basically what the devil was challenging God was, you've built a hedge around Job. You won't allow any trials or tribulations to come his way. So yeah, he's going to serve you. Who wouldn't under those conditions? So God removed his protection, I guess you could say, but God did not personally send these things. They're sent by the devil. God gives us the means and the methods to overcome these things, to use these things for our good rather than to tear us down. Remember 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, God does not allow us to be tempted but beyond what we're able to bear, but with every temptation provide a way of escape. So we need to remember that as we read this section of Scripture. Verse 7, if you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom my father does not chasten? Of course, he's talking about the general case. We can always point out exceptions to the rule, fathers that don't do their job. But a good father is going to chasten his children for their good. He's going to discipline them to help them. But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. If we aren't chastened, then I think he's drawing the parallel there to an illegitimate child. The father doesn't have any interest in the illegitimate child. He's not going to take care of his physical needs, and he's not going to take care of his training either. But that's not the case with us. Furthermore, verse 9, we have had human fathers who corrected us. Again, the general case. And what did we do? We paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? Of course, we don't always pay them respect at the time that is being dealt out. But afterwards, in hindsight, we can look and say, yeah, that was in my best interest, and I'm thankful that my father did that for me. Verse 10, for they indeed for a few days chastened us that seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Human fathers aren't perfect, and they're only able to provide this chastening for a short period of time while we're in our minority, while we're under their charge and living in their home. But God is our heavenly Father. He's always our Father in that respect. And he never makes a mistake when it comes to this chastening. And it's all for our profit. And it's for a purpose, the latter part of verse 10, that we may be partakers of his holiness. In 2 Corinthians 7, verse 1, we are to perfect holiness in our lives, something that we need to think about day by day. Am I perfecting holiness in my life? Am I truly living a life that shows that I'm separate and apart from the people of the world, that I'm someone that is set apart for God's use, and I'm taking advantage of that fact? Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present. Never has and never will be, but it's grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields its fruit. Afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. In Psalm 119, verse 67 and 71, David speaks of the chastening that the Lord provided for him, and he's thankful for it, and we need to be thankful for the chastening. It's all designed for our good. God's commandments are not burdensome. 1 John 5 and verse 3. Everything that God requires us to do as his children is designed for our benefit. God does nothing to burnish his own ego. It's all designed for our good. So therefore, because of this chastening that we need, this endurance that we need, he says, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. As I read those two verses, this image of a person comes up in my mind that's just limp and bent over, ready to give up. And he's telling us, you know, straighten up, realize that you have all of the spiritual strength available to you as we look to Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. Don't be a sad sack, so to speak, but be strong in the faith. Pursue peace with all men, and holiness without which no one will see the Lord. Again, this idea of holiness. Be ye holy, for I am holy. 1 Peter 1, verse 16. Looking diligently, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. That's not just looking at ourselves. We need to be looking out for one another. Some of our brethren might be these ones with hands hanging down and feeble knees and so forth. We need to be looking out for one another so that we can step in and help one another and encourage one another and strengthen one another. Look diligently, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. Now notice, very important, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. That's the danger sometimes with chastening, when people don't take it in the right way, don't accept it in the right way, don't use it for their own benefit, people become bitter. Someone in the family gets cancer, an unexpected death takes place, a huge financial reversal takes place, and instead of relying on the Lord to overcome these things, the danger is that a person would become bitter and start believing falsely what Satan wants you to believe, that God's got it out for you. and God doesn't have it out for us at all. But when that root of bitterness, when we allow that to spring up, it causes trouble. When the children of Israel became bitter, what did they do? They started murmuring, didn't they? They started complaining. And what did that do? That spread like wildfire among their brethren. And that's exactly the same thing it'll do today. So if that springs up, the danger is that it not only causes trouble insofar as the one that's directly affected by it, but by their murmuring and complaining, it spreads to others. And more people become defiled. They become discouraged. When you look at the children of Israel in the book of Numbers, what, 13 or so, when they're getting ready to enter the promised land and the spies come back, and the 10 spies give an evil report. They grew bitter towards God, and what happened? And that just spread through the camp like wildfire, and the whole lot of them, except for a handful, turned against God, and many became defiled. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person. A profane person is a godless person. A person that doesn't appreciate the blessings that God gives us, the instruction that God gives us. And the specific example here is Esau. And what did Esau do? He was a profane person because he sold his birthright for a bowl of bean soup. He was to be the heir, at least according to the human viewpoint, because he was the firstborn. But he sold that for such a temporary thing. I'm dying here of hunger. Well, goodness sakes, you could find something to eat, couldn't you, Esau? You're not in that bad of a shape, but he was such a worldly, carnally minded person that he did that. And we got to be careful of that, especially when we go through trials, that when we're tempted to fall away. For you know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected. Isaac had already blessed Jacob. Couldn't take, no take backs. So even though he sought it, there was no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. Again, he draws this contrast between the old and the new. For you have not come, this is another reason why we are to run the race with endurance. For you have not come to the mountain that may be touched and that burned with fire, and to blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet, and the voice of words, so that those who heard it begged that the word should not be spoken to them any more, for they could not endure what was commanded. And if so much as a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned or thrust through with an arrow. And so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I am exceedingly afraid and trembling. If you recognize that, he's talking about after they had left Egypt, and they're at Mount Sinai, when Moses to go up on the mountain, before he went up there, what happened? All of these manifestations of nature, the thunder, the lightning, the fire, and so forth, what did all of that mean? It meant that God was present on that mountain, and he was going to speak to the law to the people. But they were scared to death, and I, in many ways, don't blame them. And when they heard that voice thunder out, they asked Moses, you go up there and find out what all this is about, and you come and tell us, because we're scared to death. We have not come to that mountain now in the new covenant. We have something much better. And he's going to talk about that in verse 22. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly, and I think that's applicable to the angels, and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, that's Christians, We've not come to that mountain that couldn't be touched, that we need to be fearful of. We've come to something better. To God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. Again, these folks were scared to death. They had to get Moses to intercede and be their mediator. But we have something very different today. God is now totally approachable, isn't he? To me, it goes back a few chapters, back to chapter 4. We have a great high priest, verse 14, who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we, yet without sin. What can we do with that? Verse 16, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Totally different situation than under the old covenant. A much better situation. God is now totally approachable through our mediator, Jesus Christ. He's the perfect mediator. He's the perfect high priest. Okay. Verse 25. A warning, gentle warning, I guess you could say in some respects, but a warning. See that you do not refuse him who speaks. Again, this is my beloved son. Here, God in these last days has spoken unto us by his son. Don't refuse him then who speaks. For if they did not escape who refused him who spoke on earth, who was that? That was Moses. They didn't escape if they refused to obey him. That Moses was the lawgiver through whom God gave the law. Much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven. Again, God in these last days has spoken unto us by his Son, whose voice then shook the earth. That was back there on Sinai. But now he is promised, saying, yet once more I shake not only the earth, like he did in the olden days, but also heaven. There's going to be a shaking, we're due for a shaking of the earth and of the heavens. Now this yet once more indicates the removal of those things that are being shaken, as of things that are made, that the things which cannot be shaken may remain. The things that are made, God's creation, is going to be shaken, isn't it? 2 Peter 3, it's slated for demolition, as we might say. And that being the case, do not refuse him who speaks. Therefore, since we are receiving, that's kind of a continual action, that's not something yet in the future. We've been translated in the kingdom of the Son of his love, Colossians 1 and verse 13. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, remember in Daniel 2 when Daniel interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream, that final kingdom that was cut out of the mountain without hands was a kingdom that would never be destroyed, the Lord's kingdom, the kingdom of God. And we are receiving that. We're recipients of that, and it will not be shaken. And that being the case, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Think about what's on the horizon. May happen even yet today. The Lord is going to come again. And the universe is going to be dissolved with a fervent heat, Peter says in 2 Peter 3. All those things are going to be done away with. They're going to be shaken. And the only thing that will remain is the faithful. And you remember what conclusion Peter tried to get us to draw from that. Therefore, since seeing that these things will be dissolved, what manner of people ought we to be? And that's the same point that he's making here. We need to be serving God acceptably, that's according to his word, with reverence, with the proper respect, and godly fear. Because what is the case? Our God is a consuming fire. Think of the power it took to create the physical universe. And then on the flip side of that, think of the power it's going to take to dissolve that very same universe. And we've talked about that many times here in this congregation, of the vastness of the universe, these millions and millions and billions of light years, and that's only what we can see. And there's probably a whole bunch more beyond the limits of the human capacity to see. And one day, metaphorically, at the snap of God's fingers, that's all going to come to an end and cease to exist. And that being the case, what kind of awe and respect and obedience should we be giving God? Our God indeed is a consuming fire. Well, let's stop there. And Lord willing, we'll finish next week with chapter 13. There's no one here that's not a Christian. We would be amiss, though, if we didn't offer the invitation. If you're here and you need the prayers and the encouragement of the brethren in such a way that you would like to come forward, we would be more than happy to pray for you and with you. If you're subject to that invitation, we bid you come while we stand and sing.
Jesus is tenderly calling.